Hello, and you're very welcome to the Politics Podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. I was joined in studio today by Patsy McGarry, our religious affairs correspondent, Michael Kelly, who is editor of Ireland's best-selling religious newspaper, The Irish Catholic, and also by Áine Hyland, who's Emeritus Professor of Education at University College Cork, and was also founder of the Dalkey School Project, one of the first multi-denominational educational schools in the country in the 1970s. As the country moves on from the emphatic result of the referendum on the repeal of the Eighth Amendment, and as Irish Catholics are looking forward to the papal visit at the end of the summer, Minister for Justice Charlie Flanagan has announced plans this week for another referendum in October on removing the offence of blasphemy from the Constitution, and there may be another one again on the clause relating to the position of women in the home. In light of all this, I asked Patsy, what is the current relationship between the institutions of the state and the political establishment on the one hand, and the majority religion in this country on the other?
Well, we're looking clearly at a greater degree of separation rather than integration. This has been happening over a period of time. The referendums really, the last two referendums in particular, have illustrated publicly what's been known and happening privately for a number of decades. Ireland has been secularising, if you like, since the 1960s, probably going back to the introduction of free education by Donoghue and Malley in 1967-68, when people had been educated for the first time, the majority population anyhow, without dependence necessarily on the church, particularly at second and third level. And it led, if you like, to the cultivation of a more critical attitude to the church by educated people in Ireland. You could say it led to the so-called moral civil wars, beginning with contraception, continuing through divorce, into now abortion, and now into the constitution again, with these proposals to remove the position of the right of the woman in the home, for instance. There's even talking about removing the preamble to the Constitution itself and the issue of blasphemy, which really is a lesser issue overall. So what you have really is the growth of a proper republic, if you like, where there is a proper separation in law between church and state. I mean, it doesn't mean the church will be relegated. It means it will take its place among other churches and indeed other religions, an increasingly diverse Ireland, and a diverse Ireland which includes an increasing number of non-believers.
And what should that place be? Because, I mean, actually, we haven't had an established church in this country since the old Church of Ireland Anglican Church was disestablished in the late 19th century, although there was a specific reference to the Catholic Church in Article 44, which was deleted by the will of the people some decades ago. Other countries, many of them have established churches still. Many northern European countries, including our closest neighbour, has an established church. In many countries that are historically Catholic, the move towards a secular state was very often a painful and violent one in countries such as France and Spain. What's the Irish experience, and should we be aspiring to something, in your view, like the laïcité, as they describe it in France?
Interestingly, next year we will mark the 150th anniversary of the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland as the state church in Ireland, which will give rise to a lot of this sort of debate and discussion, I imagine, next year. We didn't have a state church in Ireland de jure, but in fact we did have one. I mean, the 1937 constitution was heavily influenced by Catholic thinking of the time, not to the degree that people thought. I mean, McQuaid, who was then president of Blackrock College and became Archbishop of Dublin in 1940, had been a colleague of De Valera's on the teaching staff of Blackrock for years. And he did have the ear of De Valera. De Valera didn't go as far as McQuaid would have preferred. Particularly, I think, when it came to the recognition of other religions in the Constitution. But the Constitution of 1937 was seriously flavoured by Catholic thinking compared to the one of 1922, which, for instance, recognised divorce, which was removed in one of the first acts of the new state in the late 1920s and gave rise to that great speech by Yeats in the Senate, Senator W.B. Yeats, about his being no petty people, referring to the Church of Ireland or Anglican community in Ireland, which would be at a disadvantage if divorce was removed, which of course it was. So you had the introduction by stealth initially and by fact through the 1937 Constitution of Catholic teaching into the Constitution. And what's happening now is that that is being removed gradually, not necessarily to the detriment of Catholics, and shouldn't be, because there'd be no imposition on Catholics to avail of contraception, which is not in the Constitution, by the way, of divorce or of abortion. In other words, it leaves it free for people who can exercise those matters in conscience and in law when they have no difficulty in doing so.
Michael, I suspect you might have a somewhat different view of the history, as Patsy's described it there.
No, I wouldn't disagree or argue with the history as Patsy sets it out. I think that's very comprehensive and very fair. I think wherever one might be coming from in any of these arguments, those are the facts following the foundation of the state. And I suppose even before the foundation of the state, you have this strange symbiosis of Catholicism and nationalism, which gave in many ways the impetus to the push for the foundation of the state. And then the state de facto became a Catholic state. It was something we were, in a sense, immensely proud of, that we had created this Ireland, to use that phrase, that was Gaelic, Catholic and free. I think we know, looking back now, that that relationship was actually very toxic and was extremely damaging towards church and state. And one of the things that's interesting, I mean, it's not perhaps the most invigorating pastime, but a pastime of mine, is ecclesiastical history. And one of the things that's interesting, if you look back over the 2,000-year history of the church, it's all those moments when actually the church thinks that it's immensely powerful and it's in bed with the state, actually when it's at its worst, and actually its capacity to witness is at its worst. Christianity at its core, more than anything else, should be something that's a countercultural witness. Well, when the thing you're lusting after is power and control and preference by the state, then you're always going to be in trouble. And I think we're seeing the outworking of that now. And I think there's a lot more of this to come from the point of view. I think Irish people are radically renegotiating what the relationship between church and state means at that national level, but also at an individual level. I mean, I've seen a lot of the coverage from overseas in the wake of the referendum. I think it was very one-dimensional in a
sense. Very simplistic.
Catholic Ireland's gone and this is the new secular Ireland. It's not as simple as that. Irish people are not as simple as that. Irish Catholics are not as simple as that. It's true that people are dramatically renegotiating what it means to be an Irish Catholic, but it would be wrong to see, I suppose, the rejection of the excesses of the past as a rejection of everything that has been traditional and Irish and Catholic by the standards of Western Europe. I mean, take one measure, it's a crude measure admittedly, but by the standards of Western Europe, mass attendance here is phenomenal. About one in three Irish people report that they go to mass at least once a week. And even allowing then for, you know, a few porkies, that's still, compared with any of the traditional Catholic countries of Western Europe, quite high.
It certainly is. Anya, you've been involved as an educationalist in many of these issues. And education, I think particularly right now, seems to be the cutting edge of where many of these debates are occurring and will occur over the next while. And through your involvement in the early stages of multi-denominational education in Ireland and your work in universities. Looking back over your experience with that, how does the Ireland in which you were initiating the Dalkey School project in the mid-1970s compare with the Ireland of today?
Yeah, I guess for me, it's a really amazing transformation. And it came in many ways very quickly. The Dalkey School project opened 40 years ago this year, so it's the 40th anniversary of the opening. And those of us who were founder members, you know, we were really pariahs in society. People didn't understand at all what we were about. There was a very strong view that we were about to kick the church out of education. All we were looking for was a choice for, at that time, a very small number of people. We were asking for one or two schools. It took 10 years to get four schools. The first four schools weren't set up for the best part of 10 years. And then after that, society began to change. That was, but it's the last 10 years I see the biggest difference, 10 to 15 years. And the speed of change was unexpected. I mean, we had carried out some statistical exercises in forecasting demand for multi-denomination education when we were trying to convince the Department of Education. And at that time, if you had told me there would be 40 schools, one school on average a year, I would have thought we would have been doing very well. Now, in fact, it's 80 schools now, but rapidly growing, and really a very significant demand for multi-denominational.
But is it possible at all? One of the commentaries that we heard in some quarters after the referendum result was that institutional Ireland, establishment Ireland, had fallen behind the actual changes in the beliefs of the people.
Yes.
And there was an expectation that even if the referendum was passed, it would be a relatively narrow margin, and that there would be a difficulty with the legislation that turned out to be less so than turned out. and that TDs and presumably also possibly civil servants and other gatekeepers in official Ireland hadn't kept up with the will of the people.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think Patsy's made a very interesting point. I wouldn't tie the change so much to free education, which again, actually 1967, 50 years ago this year was the introduction of free second level education, or last year. I would actually tie it more into the 1971 primary curriculum, which moved away from an acceptance and a everybody learned the same thing. Now it was children were encouraged to question, to ask, to be sort of self-learners. And there was a whole, it took a while. Of course, curriculum change is very slow in Ireland and in any country, but there was a change at primary level. The teachers and the children began to question and to challenge, which was not at all part of the 1922 curriculum.
I suppose I'd accept that. But Patsy, you know, I mean, I'm an atheist. I believe in rationalist values of the Enlightenment. But I can see why some people would be uncomfortable with the narrative being framed in such a way that progress and education and intellectual capability go hand in hand with a rejection of religious belief.
Well, I think that came out of our grim history, and particularly out of what has been revealed.
So it was a sort of a backlash.
It is, yeah. Over the last 20 years, particularly when we've had four statutory reports looking at the abuse of children by Catholic-run institutions, in Catholic-run institutions, and indeed by priests and parishes. We're awaiting another one in mother and baby homes. We have the current adoption scandal, which may be tied into the Mother and Baby Home Commission report. I mean, people in the adoption area want the remit of the Mother and Baby Home Commission extended to include that. And really, it's in that climate you have what you say. It is a reaction to those extraordinary and shocking revelations about abuses of the most vulnerable people, women and children in particular, by the most powerful, supervised by the church over those decades, right up to the 1970s particularly, and indeed which involved people who are still living, those who are abused are among us still. People talk about some of these issues as historic.
But there's no doubt, while that was an accelerant, I think there's absolutely no doubt that at all. There is a broader picture too, which is that in modernising, industrialising societies where people are more educated, we just need to look around at our fellow countries in Western Europe, that they tend to become less religious.
Well, there was a Pew research study published about 2 weeks ago. You know, it was Pew, the centre for research in Washington. And it looked at religious practice and it discovered, or rather established, that non-practising Christians are by far and away the biggest majority in Western Europe. You can add all other religions, practicing people in terms of practice, Muslims, Jews, practicing Christians, etc., atheists even, and still non-practicing Christians are the dominant ethos, if you want to use that word, in the entirety of Western Europe.
I have no idea what that ethos is. What is the ethos of a non-practicing
Christian? Well, they hold Christian values in the main, but they don't practice. They describe themselves as Christian. We have perfect examples ourselves. The 2016 Constitution established that 78.4% of Irish people still tick the Roman Catholic box, for instance, despite all we've heard about the abuses and scandals.
Hold that thought for a minute, because I actually want to run a clip. This is from Archbishop Eamon Martin. I think it was 2 days after the referendum result. He was speaking on RTÉ's This Week, and he was asked about the current state of belief in Ireland. We'll run it here.
We're well aware from week to week looking at our congregations that really, in Ireland now, we're dealing with really, I would see, three groups of people. We do have a very committed minority, a remnant, so to speak, of people who are deeply committed to their church and deeply convicted about the teachings of their church. We also have a large group of people, and we know this also from the census, of course, who are nominally or culturally Catholic, who will self-identify as Catholic, and who retain an affiliation with the church in some ways, but who have perhaps drifted away from regular practice of their faith. And we need to engage with and speak with these people as well. Then there's a third group of people in Ireland who have quite consciously rejected the church and who are indeed hostile to the teachings of the church. So really, I think, as I said before, the church is in a new space.
Now, Michael, I found that characterization, that tripartite characterization, fascinating. One could go into each one of them. First of all, the idea that anybody who isn't either culturally Catholic or a committed member of the faith is actively hostile to the church strikes me as a surprising and perhaps slightly worrying approach for the Archbishop today.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's entirely what he was trying to get at. I mean, anything like that characterization is going to be a little bit crude. I think there's no doubt that there is, among a small section of the population, there's an extreme hostility towards Catholicism at the moment. I mean, one even finds this in the Dáil. I mean, some of the exchanges in the Dáil, if you look back over the record, I mean, these are exchanges talking about Rome and things like this that would have embarrassed just, you know, the excesses of unionism in Northern Ireland in the 1970s, the 1980s.
So well, they're in a tradition, particularly of the left, aren't they? Of a kind of really strong, you know, and anti-religiosity, and you know, and we see that in other European countries. But and accepting the fact that it's, you know, it's a radio interview with the shortcomings that always come with those, there doesn't seem to be any space there for people of goodwill who are not Catholic, who do not identify as Catholic.
Well, I think in fairness to the Archbishop, if you go back to the interview, the question he was asked is about Catholics who disagreed with the Church on the issue of abortion. So he was, I think, specifically talking about those who were traditionally raised
Catholics.
Specifically
the challenge faced by the Church. And actually, let me ask you about that, because in a way it seems to me that if you accept that characterization, Áine, that that the big question is about this group which Patsy just referred to, this amorphous group, who it's very difficult perhaps to tell exactly what they believe. Describe them as nominal Catholics, in the case of Ireland, cultural Catholics. They're close to a majority of the population now, it seems to me. And we need to know what they want in order to know how we want to organise society, for example, in our educational system.
Yeah, I think, in my view, there is a difference between the generations. I mean, my own generation, or, you know, people of the older generation, certainly I think the Archbishop is probably the middle category and the final. They either fall into the middle or the final category, or obviously the first category. Yeah. But I think the younger generation, they're really much more neutral than anything that he has envisaged. And I mean, what brought it home to me was the realisation, which I found absolutely extraordinary, I totally unexpectedly, to when the Equate group carried out a survey and found that 24% of those who replied to it, these were families with young children, had their children baptised specifically to get them into school. I would never have believed that if I hadn't seen it myself in this survey. I suppose if you come from an Irish Catholic background, you would think of that, no matter what your beliefs were, you wouldn't do that. I mean, to me. But this generation is quite different. The younger generation, it's totally pragmatic. They have, like, religion hasn't impinged on them in the same way as the older generation.
And I think part of that's quite interesting as well. I think there are a huge number of people who go to church, go to Mass every Sunday, and the faith doesn't greatly impinge on their lives either. I mean, the British sociologist of religion, Grace Davey, she talks about in Britain they have this phenomenon where people, they believe without belonging. So she thinks that you have this kind of a silent majority of people who are religious believers, but they're not kind of affiliated to any church. I think in Ireland we have a strange phenomenon where we have people who belong but don't believe. Yeah. And there's all kinds of reasons for that, whether it's in, I mean, I don't think there's any of the past reasons of, oh, you know, you have to go to church because your neighbours will be disappointed with you if you don't go to church. But there's all kinds of social connotations there, particularly outside of Dublin. I accept that in Dublin and probably in lots of larger urban areas, though those things don't hold. But there is a phenomenon there, and that's a real challenge for the church, because it'd be much easier for the church if those people would simply walk away. But the fact is, in some ways, they've psychologically checked out, but they're still sitting in the pews.
There's a couple of things in that, Patsy. One is, I think Fintan O'Toole wrote a piece last week about the current state of the Catholic Church. He talked about John McGahern explaining to a neighbour in rural Ireland why he didn't go to church, because he felt he'd be a hypocrite if he went. And the neighbour said, but sure, we all go to see all the other hypocrites there. That's why we go there every Sunday. But the other thing, even in urban areas, that strikes me, and I think anybody listening to this who lives in Ireland will recognise this phenomenon, is people who, I was very proud of myself, I invented the phrase bouncy castle Catholics in a column a few years ago. They like the big communion party, they like the family affair, they like all that stuff, but priests and believing teachers tear their hair out because they won't see them at Mass for the 3 or 4 years between those two sacraments.
I think the perfect illustration of that is the demographic. When you look at the figures for practicing Catholics in Ireland today, urban working class Ireland, basically there's a complete absence almost of Mass attendance, down to 2-3% per week. But middle class Ireland is holding up, particularly middle class urban Ireland. Dublin 4, Dublin 6, those pariah areas of the country which used to be, are still holding up in terms of religious practice. And the belief is that that's related to schools, secondary schools in particular, because that's where most of the leading Catholic secondary schools in Dublin certainly are located, and indeed in other parts of urban Ireland as well. So it's not necessarily a matter of faith as education yet again. But to come back to a point Michael was making earlier on about people in the Dáil, and you yourself, Hugh, mainly lefty people giving very, very anti-Catholic speeches, I do not think we ever heard anything as anti-sort called Catholic as the address of Enda Kenny in the Dáil in July of 2011. Nobody would describe Endacheny as, other than Middle Ireland, a practicing devout Catholic in his form. And again, when he addressed the Magdalene issue in February of 2013, those were two deeply powerful, very affecting, very moving speeches, born out of shocking reports, but which were delivered very emotionally from a Catholic who felt disenfranchised by the activities of his church and who really gave them the lash and kicked them in the shins in style, and so doing expressed what Middle Ireland really was thinking, because he got a lot of support. He got some abuse, but he got mainly huge support for what he had to say. To come back then to the issue about young people, I think the perfect illustration of where the young are at in Ireland today, and to underline Áine's view, they are baptising their kids to get them into school. When it came to the referendum, 87% of young people between the ages of 18 and 24 voted yes. 83% of those between 24 and 35 voted yes. So they're doing one, they're being very pragmatic socially, because they have to be, because disinvestment hasn't worked so far in Ireland.
And in relation to that then, Archbishop Diarmaid Martin made an interesting point about the Catholic education system, and it is still largely Catholic. More than 90% of primary schools clearly had failed in some of their core mission.
Absolutely true, again and again and again. I mean, the churches, 96% of our primary schools are controlled by the churches and combined. Yet we have the referendum. I mean, massive support for relaxation on the laws to do with abortion. I don't have to go through the whole thing. Similarly with divorce. So the Catholic ethos, if you like, is not translating, even through this education system where most people are held for the first 17 or 18 years of life, is not translating into Catholic practice. So it's failed. And I do think that both churches, are the main church, the Catholic Church of Ireland and the Catholic Church, when it comes to primary and secondary level education, need to address that.
And that raises a very interesting question to me, Áine, because this is a politics podcast and we're looking at religion through that prism here today, which is it possible? I was reading I was reading a piece in the Sunday Times quite recently by David Quinn, where he was essentially, I think, arguing that both the Catholic Church and the state would benefit from a speedier divestment of this historical ownership of the vast majority of schools, in order for the Catholic Church, in order to be able to teach those who wanted to be taught in that way more effectively, and in order to have an education system which was more attuned to the needs of the broader population as well.
Yeah, I think as somebody who's been involved in the Educate Together sector for 40 years, I have, while of course I supported the concept of divestment when it was first mooted, I never thought it would work. And I just felt that the whole structures of primary education, the legal setup was such, and the way it runs, and particularly the view that obviously if you are going to divest a Catholic school and hand it over to a non-church patron, that there has to be buy-in from the community. People, by and large, are happy with their schools. The fact that it's a Catholic school is neither here nor there for most of them, if they have got their children into the school. That's the reality, I think. I'm also concerned I welcome the baptism barrier being removed, to use that phrase that's being used. But I don't think it's going to work. I don't think it can happen. I think constitutionally, I was on the Constitution Review Group, which reported in 1996. There's a very good section there about how you cannot discriminate between one church and another. Which the legislation proposes to do. Jared Hogan wrote that. Now, Jared Hogan is going to Europe now, but, I mean, if you were in the Appeals Court or the Supreme Court, I think I know what the answer would be if somebody challenges that. I think it's, but not only might it be challenged, I wonder will it be signed into law? Will the Council of State have to look at it? I'm only a lay person in that sense. I have no legal expertise. I cannot see how that...
Just for the benefit of our listeners, there's a specific requirement on Catholic schools to remove this barrier, but it does not apply to other faiths, Church of Ireland and other faiths.
To minority.
I attended the forum on patronage. I reported on it for the paper 6 years ago.
You did indeed.
And John Coolan. I met John many times afterwards, and he was tearing his hair out in sheer frustration at the lack of effect on the ground of disinvestment. I mean, I know the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin here and Bishop Leo O'Reilly of Kilmore were both very, very much in favour of it.
They were in favour.
I mean, Dermot Martin has pointed out that 75% of the population of Dublin are Catholic, at least nominally. And yet, I mean, they still control the vast majority of primary schools. But they can't, as Áine says, get people on the ground to shift. And and there's no leadership at a local level. People see it the school, it's not broke, why fix it, is the attitude. So, I mean, I don't think divestment is going to work.
No.
The question then is what would work? I mean, the implication there, Michael, is that the state and church, perhaps together, would intervene in a more proactive way.
Yeah, look, I think the church has to take the lead here. I mean, the divestment issue is this problem. Everyone is in favour of it at a national level, but not until it affects their local school. So that's the issue. So I think the church here needs to take the lead. The church needs to be realistic. Dermot Martin likes to talk about, you know, that various referenda being a reality check for the church. They are a reality check for the church. And the reality is that he who tries to hold everything in the end holds nothing. So the church trying to hold 90% of schools, as if somehow those schools are authentically Catholic, as if somehow the vast majority of people who send their kids there want to be sending their children to a Catholic school. No one in the church believes that, and I think it's time to just start saying things like
that. Do you agree with Patsy's point that there will be strong resistance locally on the ground from parents and families?
I think what you need there on the ground is you need strong leadership. You need the local priest, you need local community people saying, look, this is no longer our reality, or this no longer meets our reality. We do not need 3 Catholic primary schools in this parish anymore. Perhaps we need 1. I think if you have that local leadership, and, you know, talking to a lot of priests, I think a lot of priests are up for that. The last thing they want is spending their evenings going around chairing boards of management meetings about very, very complex staffing
issues. For most parish priests, it's a pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is a source of huge rows locally, politically, whatever.
And they don't have the expertise for it.
They would be delighted to get rid of it. The difficulty is, again, the absence of priests is going to be something they'll have to address anyhow very, very, very shortly. So you'll be dealing with lay Catholics, which can be even more difficult politically, and who are less...
You're saying they're even worse than the priests, Pat. Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't even say the priests are even worse, frankly. But certainly some of the people who would put themselves into those sort of positions can be far more difficult to deal with than any priest would be.
The difficulty as well, there's no one in charge of lay Catholics. I mean, at least if you have a difficult priest, a bishop will step in.
Absolutely.
And is there an issue on it at all with all the... These schools are almost exclusively funded by the state or by some combination of the state and private fees in the case of those fancy Southside schools, which Patsy was referring to. Yeah. The churches own the land for the most part. They own the property.
The parish owns the land.
And is there... And when you were looking at this, is there a challenge with that in terms of the transfer of those assets?
Oh, yeah, there's a huge challenge. I mean, it's not impossible, but there is a huge challenge. I mean, going right back to the early 19th century when the national school system was set up, it was set up on the basis that the land on which the schools would be built was to be privately owned. Initially, by landlords, they had assumed, but of course that didn't happen. And it was the churches generally who owned the land. They get about now 90-95% up to 100% of the cost of the building. Now that has changed from the state. Yeah, so that the building, if you like, is belong to the state, but it's on the land that belongs to the church. And what can you do? So I was of the view for a very long time that when a school, that it could be divested quite easily, in that the minister was a party to the official lease of a school and that he had a role in this. And certainly in the old days, that's how it would have been perceived. But I gather that more recent legal advice is like, it's the land that determines it, and that's...
Well, ironically, the original national school system in 1831 was set up on a non-denominational basis.
It was meant to be a mixed system.
And what happened was that the Protestant churches became worried that they would be swamped. And so they were the ones who insisted on denominational education. And, of course...
I think it's good we finally got to blame the Protestants at some point in this podcast.
I think the challenge here politically as well, though, I think, is around the financing of the schools. I mean, it's true that the day-to-day running cost of the schools are, you know, by and large met by the state. But you talk, particularly around Dublin, you talk to most parish priests, they are fundraising constantly to pay heating bills, to pay electricity bills. So, I mean, is the state going to take on all of that? Ringsend Parish in Dublin, the parish bingo there held every weekend pays the heating bill of the local school. So the state is going to have to step up with more money if it's serious.
Isn't there a broader problem here, though, to broaden it out a little bit, Michael, which is that, as you referred to the fact that there isn't a structure or leadership with among lay Catholics, so you're dependent on a dwindling number of clergy, that in other Catholic countries there's a tradition of having, say, a Christian Democratic Party, which essentially represents the interests and the values of that portion of the population who hold to those beliefs. And because of the sort of the universal control exerted by the Catholic Church for so long through a clergy, we don't have that here. And now, as that disappears away like snow in a ditch. What are we left with on the Catholic side to represent, in the words of some people after the referendum, who speaks for the 34%?
Yeah, I mean, there was never any need for it, I suppose, because we were such a homogenous society. I mean, the idea in the 1920s or the 1930s of a Christian Democratic Party would have been absolutely foolish because, you know, that was really all of the parties. I think the challenge now is politically, who does represent that 34%? If you like, Fine Gael in the last general election got about 26% of the vote. So the 724,000 people who voted no, you know, they are not a small group, or, you know, Archbishop Martin used the word remnant in his clip, which I think is interesting, because if you look at the Bible, the word remnant is always used in Israel to mark a small community which regrows. But I think there is a huge challenge. Where do those Catholics go politically? But yet I think the other side of that debate is any attempt to try to galvanise that or try to represent that has failed dismally. I mean, we've had very, very small attempts, things like the Christian Solidarity Party, which, you know, never really got any more than a couple of hundred votes nationally. Even things like Renew, you know, which on the face of it at least were much more credible, and even after the departure of their leader Lucinda Creighton, actually I think moved even more into that kind of Catholic space, and it hasn't done anything for them. I mean, I think they have a couple of councillors elected around the country, but they were elected as independents and later joined Renew. So I think we do have this dilemma now. We do have all of these people who by and large probably think at least their social values or socially conservative values are not represented by the political mainstream, but they don't seem to be drifting elsewhere.
Well, let's be able to mobilise around those issues.
I mean,
one
of the questions is, I mean, Patsy was quoting the numbers earlier about the number of people who voted yes in the referendum. The remarkable thing to me was that 30,000 18 to 24 year olds actually voted no in the referendum. So if you were an 18 to 24 year old and you voted no in the referendum, you are fairly mobilised around this issue. But where is the thing that gathers those people together? Because a groundswell of 30,000 people in their early 20s around the country is a remarkable movement.
Because there is an argument made, Patsy, by people on the social conservative / Catholic side, which is that the homogeneity of the old Ireland has been replaced by homogeneity of the new Ireland, and that it's equally difficult. I'm not sure if I agree with this part of it, but the argument is made that it's equally difficult to be a dissident on the other side now as it was in the old days.
I mean, Fianna Fáil is interesting in this context. Quite a significant number of the parliamentary party took a very strong stance for no during the referendum campaign, much more so than was the case of Fine Gael. It is perceived to be an older party in terms of age, profile, of its TDs. It's certainly more rural. Yeah. Now, its leader has gone one way, and the party, it would appear, a significant number of the party have remained as they were. So, I mean, there's a possibility there, future-wise.
Well, recent electoral results in the UK and the US show that, you know, you can win with an older, rural, more conservative vote.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I mean whether Fianna Fáil will actively, particularly with the way the leadership is going in one direction and the rest of the party, or significant element of the party, going in there, will actually take that position, it's very hard to say. I don't know if they'll have time, anyhow, to now in the next general election. But there's an interesting evolution possibly happening there.
How much of this, Áine, is stuff that Irish people talk about rather than do anything about? What I'm wondering is, I mean, we know that there have been some constitutional changes, and
yes,
Patsy mentioned a couple of others which are impending, and perhaps one or two others which we might consider, like the preamble to the Constitution as well. They seem to me, we had a little argument about this very subject last week in our studio, but they seem to me to be largely symbolic. The position of women in the home is not something that's had a legal consequence in a courtroom that I'm aware of over the last several decades. Blasphemy, perhaps, does have more directly legal consequences.
Well, women in the home, for my generation.
For your generation.
For my generation.
You weren't allowed to get a job.
No, I was a civil servant. I had to resign on marriage, and I was out of work for a decade before the marriage.
So it was used as an excuse for that, although when the policy was changed, nobody was able to say, oh no, you know, it's in the Constitution.
It was because of Europe,
It was totally because of Europe.
Paddy Ginnery was Minister for...
Absolutely, totally. We went into Europe in 72 and the marriage ban was lifted in 73. Yeah. So it was entirely to do with Europe.
So I suppose the question is, do we need to take a broader look at the Constitution as a whole, which was framed in a very different Ireland,
Should we?
Should we have a new one?
I mean, I sat for 2 years on the Constitution Review Group chaired by T.K. Whittaker, a wonderful man. It was a great experience. What surprises me is that so little has happened. Mm. I know, and you know, it's the Constitution Review Group, and then there was a whole series of other reports, and then there was the Citizens' Assembly, and are we going to put it off forever? The preamble, we had considerable discussion about the preamble. We had considerable discussion about the place of the women in the home, and the report is there. You know, you can, you know, it's a
for the benefit of our listeners, the preamble makes reference to the Most Holy Trinity. Mm. You can probably read it off.
I can't off the top of my head now. Don't do that to me, Hugh.
I mean, an infinitely more important thing in the Constitution, certainly infinitely more important than blasphemy, which I find remarkable that there's no political interest about, is this idea that people still have to take religious oaths. So it really means that you cannot, in good conscience, be the president of this country and be an atheist.
Or Chief Justice.
That, to me, is a remarkable thing. I mean, as a person of faith, I mean, I don't want anyone who isn't religious having to swear on the Bible. You know, to me, it seems remarkable that there's
so
no push around
that. So the fact that we institutionalise hypocrisy in that way, is that something specifically Irish, it seems?
I think we're very good at it. I think we're very good at agreeing not to notice things or agreeing not to know certain facts.
Hypocrisy knows no nationality. But I mean,
we do it pretty well.
The irony, I try personally, but for instance, I thought one of the ironies about the recent referendum is that polling booths had a copy of the Bible there for people to swear that they were who they were if needs be. So I mean, there's an inherent contradiction there, a traditional one, but there you are.
Yeah. Michael, finally, maybe I'll come to you. I mean, what hope do you have, or what expectation do you have, that a future Ireland, let's say in 10 or 15 years' time, might both reflect the values and the beliefs which you espouse, but do so in a way which is more appropriate to the people as a whole, as well as Catholics?
Yeah, I think what we need to be striving for is an Ireland that's pluralist. I mean, one of the greatest developments of my adult life in Ireland has been the phenomenal multiculturalism that's everywhere to be seen now, and the fact that we've handled it very well. Because
including a range of other religions,
absolutely.
Here before.
And one of the interesting things about the vast majority of immigrants who come here, they are actually religious, you know, so they're changing the religious demographic, but it still will mean that the country will be, by and large, quite a religious country. We've handled that transition very, very well. We've had all kinds of predictions from other parts of Europe about how awful it would be and we wouldn't be able to manage it. We've managed it very, very well so far. I would like to see us managing pluralism properly, a place where everyone can have their values respected, have their views respected, feel that they're able to talk in the public sphere. I get it now that there's a kind of reaction to the overdominance of the church in the past. And look, sometimes people say to me, oh, you'd love to live in the 1950s. I would have hated the 1950s. And I think actually, as a Northern Catholic, I think it's more difficult for us to understand as well, because in the 1980s, 1990s, if you were a Northern Catholic, you could buy condoms if you wanted to. Sure, your church would frown upon you, you could do it if you wanted. You could get divorced if you wanted to. Sure, your church would frown on you, but you could actually do it. Catholics in the Republic, it was such a hothouse. They couldn't do anything like that. So I think we have to understand the reaction to that over-dominance of the church that was there in the past. But I hope we'll be able to find an equilibrium where people can, you know, truly live and let live.
Michael, Áine, Patsy, thanks very much for coming in today. And that's it for this edition of Inside Politics. Thanks to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, and engineer, JJ Vernon. Remember, you can subscribe to us on iTunes.com or your preferred podcast provider. We always welcome a review or a rating or a share because it helps to get us out to a broader audience. You can also find us at irishtimes.com/podcasts. You can mail me at hlinahan@irishtimes.com, or you can get me on Twitter. But until the next time, goodbye, and thanks very much indeed for listening.